Welcome to the Last Round MMA.
The guy's never beaten me. In order to be the champion, you have to beat the champion.
A podcast for the MMA fan.
Imagine that. Look at everybody up here. They're all dressed like me. They're all trying to talk like me. They're all trying to be me.
Bringing you in-depth interviews and more from across the MMA world.
This is like pride. You know, everybody's here. I feel great. And, you know, I can't wait. Saturday night, I'm going to crush this guy hype.
Are you ready? Let's start the show.
Welcome to episode one of the Last Round MMA podcast. This new podcast, we'll hopefully bring you some revealing in-depth interviews from around the MMA world. And today, our first guest, probably the most recognizable cut man in all of fight sports, we have Jacob Stitch Duran. Well, thanks for joining me, Stitch.
Hey, well, thanks, man. You know, I like being part of history. And there's been a lot of moments where, you know, I've worked some great fights and been part of history. And they've done three movies with Sylvester Stallone. That's part of history. But now I'm here in the last round being your first guest. So that's part of history. So good luck, man. You know, I wish you guys all the best. And I'm sure you guys will do quite well.
Awesome. Thank you. I appreciate that. So no better place to start. So obviously you grew up in Northern California. You started working at like 5 years old. If you could just tell us about, you know, how it was growing up in Northern California.
Yeah, it was great, you know, and I grew up as a farm worker. As you know, I'm very proud to let people know because of, you know, where I started at and where I'm at now. I'm just the face that anything and everything is possible, because I'm no different than anybody else, right? But I grew up as a farm worker, and, you know, I worked in the fields every summer when the crops were ready to be picked, and in the winter when, you know, they were preparing them, and, you know, but that was where I started my life, and that's what kept me humble and always giving back, because that's the way I grew up. Family was very giving, and we helped a lot of farm workers, as migrant workers, as they came in from, you know, all parts of the country and Mexico and all that. My parents would always help them get established. So that's been my nature.
You think that instilled good characteristics in you, you know, like hard work, dedication?
Yeah, 100%. You know, and that's why, you know, I always go back and I'm not scared to challenge what's ahead of me, because our family, we always have a little thing that, you know, if that doesn't work, at least we know how to go pick cotton and peaches and tomatoes, and, you know, so at least we know that, you know. But that's kept me quite humble, and it's given me that work ethic.
Do you look back on that time fondly?
All the time, you know, all the time, to the point where if you'll notice now that you'll notice during the fights, on my collar, it says Planada, Planada. Oh, that's my hometown. Like 1,500 people, all farm workers, you know, for the most part, you know, hardworking people. So I do that as a tribute to them, to always give back and inspire them. And of course, it's been a tremendous road.
And then you actually later joined the Air Force, and that's where you kind of fell in love with mixed martial arts.
Yeah, I walked down to Merced College after high school. The college was 9 miles away from my town, and I didn't have a car, you know. So I would go to school with friends, and after school they would leave, and I would stay, and I'd practice baseball with the team, and then I would have to kind of hitchhike back home, right? And I was naive. You know, I didn't know I could go talk to the coach and maybe the counselors about getting grants and, you know, getting scholarships or something. So I didn't know all that. So I joined the military, the Air Force, in 1972. And a couple years later, in 1974, they stationed me in Utapau, Thailand. And I always told myself, if I went into the military, if I went to the Orient, I'd always want to study the martial arts. So I saw my first Muay Thai fight, and I got hooked on it. And on the base, they had Taekwondo for the GIs, the American, the soldiers. But then they left like 3 months later, and the Thais came in and they took over the program and kind of transitioned us. So that's how I got my start.
I saw in a previous interview that you said that the Thais used to call you Bruce Lee.
Yeah, I saw my dude Bruce Lee. They would walk out by the cab drivers, right? Because we would train at the gym. And then I had a gi, right? And so you'd go to the gym with your gi and you'd work out, and it's all sweaty, and because the barracks were real close to the gym, and the cab drivers would all be there. They say, "Ah, Sawadee, Bruce Lee, Sawadee." And then they would kind of challenge me, ah, kunato, you know, you want to fight? And then, you know, so I'd mess with them. And lovely people, lovely, lovely people, man. But that whole year I was there, I dedicated myself to the sport. And ironically, Master Skin is out of Manchester, and he's with the Sitting Not Home Association. But he was a young student when I was there. I was, I think, 20 years old, and he was trained at the University of Bangkok, but he would come and train with his brother, Mr. Kit, Mr. Wan, and all that. And this guy was the next best thing to Bruce Lee, but now he's a top trainer in the UK.
And then you came home and you actually opened up the American School of Kickboxing with a credit card, I believe.
Yeah. I tell you, I'm a little crazy, you know. I had a good job. I was with RJ Reynolds Tobacco Company. I worked with them for 23 years and had a company car, and I drove around with the ties, sold Winston's, Salem's, and Campbell's and cigarettes. But it taught me the business aspect of this. And I when I got out of the military, I lived in Oakland, California, and I got into boxing just to improve my hands. And then I started working with amateur boxers. And then years later, I moved to the suburbs to Fairfield. I was already working with kickboxers at that time. Dennis Alexio was the light heavyweight and the heavyweight champ of the world. He came out as the brother in the movie Kickboxer with Van Damme. He was the brother in the wheelchair. I'm crazy me. I walked into one of my accounts and they had cut their store in half, and they offered me the first 3 months to, you know, open my school there. And with a credit card, I bought the bags, the equipment, the carpet, the mirrors, and people had already known me as a trainer. I was already a trainer, so, and we were trained at like a different facilities. So I had my own school and it became successful. The American School of Kickboxing, ASK, A-S-K. And Javier Mendez, when he got his gym, American Kickboxing Academy, I said, hey, man, I started with the initials. You know, I used to work with Javier all the time when he was a fighter. So Scott Coker, you know, I knew him for many years when my fighters used to fight on his card. And, you know, that's how I got started. And here I am in Vegas.
And that was how you kind of transitioned into the cutman role because of you were a coach?
Yeah. I did everything. I was a coach. I was a manager. I managed the guys. And, you know, I've been promoted some shows, 3 shows, I think. But being a cut man, because I wanted to know everything inclusive and economics also. But I wanted the one-on-one with my fighters. And being a cut man, I love training. You know, I love training fighters. But being that I had an 8-to-5 job with RJ Reynolds, I couldn't give you 100%. And it wasn't fair to you, you know. So, but when I moved to Vegas, I ended up doing hand pads for a lot of fighters. Mike Tyson, they did pads with Tyson, and people would hire me to do that. So I would kind of sneak off of work and go work with these guys, because for the most part, pro boxers trained from like 12 to 3 in the afternoon. So I would get off work, go do pads for guys like Mike Tyson and Johnny Tapia and Francho Bolta when he fought Tyson, then go back to work. And, you know, so yeah, that was my life.
You actually took a pay drop, I read, to move from California to Vegas to follow the dream.
Yeah. I had a good job with RJ Reynolds, and I wanted to follow my dreams and move to Las Vegas. At that time, it was only boxing. So, you know, here's where a good wife and a good family come, because they all supported me, right? But the only position, well, I waited for a while, but I knew that it was going to come because the company was starting to download or downsize. And so I get a call and they tell me that there was an opening in Las Vegas and I don't have to do no traveling, but I have to be there in a week. And, you know, a family, a gym, this house and all that. I talked to the manager 2 weeks, bro. And in 2 weeks, I tell you, I sold my house. I transferred my school to one of the fighters, Randy Bussart. I put my family in a U-Haul and I drove 9 miles to Las Vegas to do what I did. But the only position that was available was a secondary position lower than me. So I took like a $25,000 a year cut. Hey, crazy as could be. My wife, you know, they supported me all the way. And my brother lived there and he kind of helped me get acclimated and all that. And yeah, I rolled the dice and came out okay.
Did you have any mentors which helped you in the role as a cut man?
Yeah, you know, I had one guy. Let me go back to when I still lived in the Bay Area, right? I was at a, at then it was only boxing. There was, and kickboxing, but kickboxing was not like MMA. But I was learning to be a cut man, and I was at a boxing event. Marvis Frazier fought, Joe Frazier's son fought Bone Crusher Smith. And I'll never forget, but one of the undercard fights, the cut man did a good job on the fighter that he worked on. He had cut and did a good job. So I went up to him and I said, hey, you know, I'm trying to learn to be a cut man. Can you tell me what you did? And he looks at me, he says, fuck you, because I'm taking this to my grave and you got to learn like me. And he walked away. And I thought, wow, man, that's the way it was at boxing. I felt about this big. But I said, I'd never be like this man. You know, so my job is now to teach and to, but one of my mentors was Chuck Bodak. And this is going way back, probably when you were still a young man, but Chuck Bodak worked with Oscar De La Hoya, Julio Cesar Chavez, a lot of good Mexican fighters. And he looked like Colonel Sanders and he had the white beard and this and that, but he used to put tape on his head with the picture of fighters. And when I worked my first big fight in Vegas, Raul Marquez got cut like 5 times. And I had worked on cuts before. I came into Vegas, nobody knew who I was, but I had that experience in kickboxing. And I saved Raul Marquez's fight. He ended up with like 70 stitches. And Chuck Bodak came and congratulated me and said I did a great job. And was the first guy to really welcome me into the boxing world because it was a very, very close society. And turns out that him and I did the movie Play to the Bone with Woody Harrelson and Antonio Banderas. So he was the guy that really helped me. He influenced me a lot. And in boxing at that time, they wouldn't help nobody. But now that's why if anybody has questions, I'll answer the questions because I never wanted to be like this guy that told me to fuck off. But, you know, I worked with Andre Ward, which is great, great undefeated light heavyweight champion of the world and gold medalist and all that. And we went back to open for Andre to fight, and payback's pretty good, man, because him, he forgot about it. But him and his son came and they wanted to take a picture with me, you know, because my status has grown. And I did, but I thought to myself, I won this battle because this guy forgot about that. I've never mentioned his name, but he forgot about it, but I never did. And that just helped influence what I do now.
So starting out as a cut man, you've kind of really got to start at the bottom, cut your teeth, learn the training, and then kind of gradually work up?
Man, it's a hard road. You know, it's a road of passion. I get calls, emails all the time from doctors and paramedics and EMTs and nurses and housewives and guys that want to be cut men. They said, oh, I was a cut man and I was a medic in the military, or I'm a fireman, and what's it take to be a cut man? So here's what I tell them in all honesty, and you know, because you know, you train also, is you have to spend hours and days and weeks and months and years in the gym working as a fighter, being part of that clique and understanding not only the physical aspect, but the psychological aspect of what these fighters go through. And during those moments, you have to donate your time and your own expenses. You have to wrap fighters' hands, learn techniques, work with guys working corners and build yourself up till you get to a level where these fighters are going to have confidence in you. So it's not an easy road. It's a long road. And I tell people, for the most part, if you do it for the money, you're going to do it for the wrong reasons. And you know, so yeah, it's a tough road, but everybody wants, you know, they see what I do, but they don't know the road that I took to get to where I'm at. And you're talking about when I first moved to Las Vegas. Oh, about 3-4 months into me living there, my brother Michael came by the house and my wife was crying. And he thought we got into a fight, but I couldn't pay my rent, bro, you know? And he lent me money. And from there on, you know, I never looked back, you know, and I paid him back, you know, with interest and all that. But I was at that point, and I'm sure if I ask you questions, you've probably been at that point also, and so I have a lot of other people. But you could overcome them, and like I say, I'm no different.
After moving to Vegas, I think I'm right in saying that you used to sell equipment, and that's how you met Dana White?
Well, yeah, I used to, I've always been an entrepreneur one way or the other. I used to have my own line of boxing equipment, and that time, well, first I started with a company called M&M, which was, he was the guy, Manuel Moreno from Mexico, that helped create the Beto Reyes gloves. So I used to sell his equipment, and then, you know, I had my own line of tape and my own kale swell, and but I knew Dana in the gyms, and more so in the gyms than you know, through equipment, but he was always there. I was working with fighters. Dana was doing pads for the housewives and, you know, the casino owners, and shit, he was making more money than us, you know, and, you know, working with fighters, and, you know, you don't get rich with fighters, you know, and so that's how I knew Dana. But yeah, I always been an entrepreneur, and, you know, now I have my my Stitch Premium athletic tape and the Chaos Well. The Chaos Well that I designed, actually, we were coming back from London, I think, and I was sitting with Kenny Florian for the UFC, and we're in the airport, and we're talking business, and a bottle like this, I go like this, and these bottles are kind of curved on the inside. I said, God, that makes so much sense. Because when, and here's the educational part, when you deal with swelling, you dwell because blood is accumulating underneath the tissue. So you would see guys that would try to do this and move that clot over here, but you go into tissue that's damaged, and then it still comes back and gets a little bigger. So the advice that you get from the ringside doctors is cold, direct pressure, right? So I thought about it one day, and I thought, you know what, it makes so much sense. So the KO swell that I have is curved on one side and it's flat on the other, in case you have to go to flat sides. It's common sense, right? Mm. But those are available at, you could go to cutmanforhiresupplies.com. Wander Ramirez carries my product. Plus he carries all the other great stuff for trainers and cutmen and cornermen. And if you gotta go to somebody that's in the business, like me, I know the tape, I know the kale, so I created that. Juan knows all the, because he's a cut man also. So go get your equipment there, man. I highly recommend it.
And can you just tell us about how Dana kind of opened the door for you to work in the USC for all those years?
Yeah, you know, I was working at K1 at the Bellagio. And talk about Scott Coker, because Scott Coker used to handle the K1 in the United States. And he would bring me on board, kind of like what the USC does. That Bob Sapp was fighting Chemo, and Mike Tyson was in the audience, right? So after the fight, Mike Tyson and Bob Sapp are kind of, you know, they're doing their promotional thing, right? And I see Dana in the audience, and he said, "Hey, give me a card." He goes, "Give me a card. I'm gonna talk to you." So next day he calls us, "Hey, man, we bought the UFC, and you know." We're asking to see if you're interested in being a cut man, you know, because Dana knew me through the sport. We were in the sport. And at that time, it was only Leon Taft, the legendary cut man from UFC number one. Yeah, it was a great opportunity for me. And not knowing MMA, I didn't know nothing about MMA. I knew about kickboxing. I knew about boxing, but I knew nothing about grappling, but I know cuts and I know wraps. And Dana, when they bought the reason I said, why, yes, is because when they bought the UFC, I'll go back. The original UFC, I quit watching it because it was a little too brutal. You know, and me being a martial artist, you know, and being a cut man, I saw a lot of fault in that. But when Dana called me, he says, you know, him, Lorenzo Fertitta and Frank Fertitta, they created like 43 rules or something like that to make the game safer. And for that, I said, yeah, you know, it makes so much sense. And the first show that I did was UFC 33, I think, at the MGM here in Las Vegas or Mandalay Bay. But Burt Watson, I just talked to Burt Watson yesterday. And we were talking about how when they brought me in, what we created with Burt Watson getting the fighters there on time and having the fight start on time, behind the scenes, Burt Watson's the one that created that whole formula. The formula that we use now, all the cut men in MMA, if you notice now, all the with the formula that the cut men use, and even now some of the young guys in boxing, is something that I created. And that's wearing gloves. Always wear gloves because it's filthy. See, I looked at the boxing cut men. Let me go back. Boxing cut men, you'll see them. They got the swabs in their mouth. Mm. They got them in the ear. Mm. They got no gloves. All that is filthy. You know, when you look at a fighter safety, you minimize the things that will give them long-term damage. Being filthy is one of them. Mm. So you see these guys wear gloves. the wrist wrap here where you put the swabs in instead of the mouth. We got that. They put the Vaseline here. So when they're working on the fighter, it's like an artist, right? They use small towels to wipe and all that. Those are techniques that I've used for a long time that I implemented when with these guys that were working in the UFC, and they work. Those are the best techniques to as quickly as you can in the 50 seconds to do what you have to do. And then, you know, putting the swab and pinching on the cut and all that. So yeah, so we are the ones that created that. And now everybody, a majority of people are using them. In MMA, everybody uses that formula. Take a look.
In MMA, when you were in the UFC, you were just kind of assigned a corner, correct? You're not assigned like certain fighters. So you'd take the blue corner. Another cut man would take the red corner.
Yeah, it's funny, but it goes deep into that before that, because when Dana brought us in, MMA was such a new sport that the trainers, even though they're great trainers, they didn't know how to wrap hands. Mm-hmm. They didn't know how to work cuts. So our thing was to offer them the opportunity for us to wrap their hands. And of course, everybody jumped on it. So, but it became a little bit, I guess maybe it's an honor, but it's extra work. A lot of people wanted me to wrap their hands. And I mean, like Kenny Florian, he would call me before the weeks before the fight and ask me if I would wrap his hands. Guys would call me, and it's tough to say no, you know. So that's one of the things that we offered them. Plus, at that time, it was only Leon Tabbs and myself. And Leon was the old school cut man that, you know, really he worked on cuts, but he really didn't understand the system. So the red corner was where everybody walked in. And that's usually where the champs were at. So Burt Watson and I decided it'd be best if I worked that corner. That way we could, you know, check with the judges, the doctors and all that, and make sure that, you know, Leon's okay. And so I got that position for a while. And then after a while, as the guys got better, then we started giving them the main events and all that. But yeah, that was the reason why, because I kind of controlled what went on with the cut men when they were going to, let's say they wanted me to go wrap their hands, and I would assign, let's say, Don House. So Don House coming to replace me, I'd go to the back and I'd go wrap whoever I had to wrap. So yeah, we put that together.
I also read that you offer a tap out wrap and a knockout wrap. Yeah. What's the difference?
Yeah, there is a difference. Number one is psychology. All right. So if you're getting ready to go out there and fight, what's your best way of winning a fight? Is to render your opponent unconscious, the knockout, right? So, and I understand, because the wrap that I use in MMA is the same exact wrap that I use in boxing. Because if it works for boxers, it works for MMA guys. Except that you don't put as much padding, because the padding in boxing is thicker, because the gloves are so smaller. But the thing you have to do is protect the metacarpals. And you can notice I got a little lump here. Protect the metal, well, the knuckles, the metacarpals, the wrist, the thumb. Those are the points. So when I ask them if they want the knockout wrap or the tap out wrap, what I'll do is I'll go through the regular wrap, but then I'll do more layers, additional layers, and just kind of protect those metacarpals, because as you make contact, you don't want your hand to be doing this. If you're a grappler, you're going to do the tap out. A lot of the Brazilian guys wanted the tap out wrap. You know, but you just don't put as much. You make it a little bit more flexible, but you still protect these points of interest right here. So, but psychology, man, had a lot to do with it. And if you ask me, if I took a survey, who wanted more knockout wraps or tap out wraps, a knockout wrap won. So only because of that. But a good question. Good question. Very few people have asked that question.
It's funny that you touched on psychology, because obviously during this, I did a lot of, you know, research before having you on there. And it's funny how like people like Misha Tate, Vitor Belfort, you know, spoke about you, saying that they knew that when you were in their corner, you brought such a calming effect. And Misha Tate kind of touched on how you brought confidence into her camp. What is it that sets you apart, you think, that brings that in?
Well, being there and knowing, you know, and you know, yeah, my nature's always been like that, you know, but you know, working with knives, that's what I said, you got to spend hours and days and weeks and months and years with these guys. No, it's, you know, Mike Tyson, I interviewed Mike Tyson, and I said, Mike, every fighter has that one little thing that nobody in the world has. What's that one little thing? Very simply, he says, take the pain. You have to take the pain. And as I thought about it, I realized that he's absolutely right, because pain in training, pain in the fights, pain financially, pain with your family, just pain. So I understand those things. And deep inside, even though these guys are modern day gladiators, they're all babies, right? And a good example, one of the things that really kind of made sense is that when Lyoto Machida fought Rashad Evans, Lyoto won the world title from Rashad Evans. And if you remember, Lyoto's father was a very proud Japanese samurai warrior type of guy. So after the fights, I go in the dressing room and I congratulate Lyoto on his victory, because I was the one that always wrapped his hands and he always wanted me to work his corner. And I did during that fight. So I go in the dressing room and I congratulate him, and his father's standing there very, very proud. And in front of his father, he says, "Steech, in the corner, you are my father." And I thought, wow, that was such a, you know, honorable statement. And his father just kind of acknowledged that, you know. Carol Parisian, when he fought Drew Ficker, this years back early, this is in the Marine base here, we're supporting the troops. But he ended up with a big old gash right here, man. And Manny Gambarian was just, I didn't even know Manny at that time. He was just starting to get into the UFC mix. But him and his coach, Neil, they get into the corner, and I'm starting work on Carol. But before that, he, you know, the doctor calls timeout, or the referee calls timeout. They bring the doctor in, and Carol's on the knees, and he looks at the big screen, and he goes like this, and he opens up the cut. So it kind of freaked him out. So when he got to the corner, these guys were freaked out. And my job as a cut man is not to give instructions, but I've been there. And I understood under that circumstance that I had to take control, because this meant a lot to Carol, but to any fighter. So I told Carol, I'm working on him. I said, look, man, don't worry about the cut, man. You just stay on the stand-up and you'll be fine, you know? And he did, and he ended up winning the fight with Drew Ficken. But going fast forward, we did a show at the MGM here in Las Vegas, and I'm walking by, and Carol's sitting in the audience with his father, and I go and say hi to Carol, and they're very strong Armenian families, and like Mexican families, very family. And but the father says, he goes, I want to thank you for taking care of my son, because I would like to invite you to my house for dinner, you know. And he lives in LA, I live in Las Vegas. That wasn't going to happen, but the thought of his father doing that to me was just, that's why I do it, is because of those moments.
I read an article as well about, I think it was Clay Guida's mother turned to you and said, take care of my son.
Yeah, Clay Guida's money. And I've heard it from Michael Chandler's parents, you know, take care of my son. I said, yeah, of course, you know, they understand. And, you know, and it's funny you say that, because to this point, Clay Guida's mom is still, you know, we communicate on Facebook all the time. But yeah, you know, and the thing about it, you know, whether you are a world champion or whether you were just making your debut, I'm going to treat you as if you're a world champion, because you deserve that. And my job is to maximize the safety factors for any guy that I work with. And, you know, Frank Mir, you're talking about the quote, Vitor Belfort said that quote, that when I see Stitch walking into the dressing room, whether I know he's working the other corner or not, he brings that calming effect. Frank Mir, another great quote, he says, when I see Stitch walking into the dressing room, my stomach just drops, because I know it's time to fight, you know, and it's legit. But these are all moments that I got tons of them, bro. You know, that they blow my mind, and they're all true. You know, they're just great moments that have happened to me.
How is it for you, and how, you know, how do you calm them down emotionally? Because like you touched on, you know, they're modern day gladiators, and you're the last contact they have before they go to war.
Yeah. You know, I every time when I wrap their hands, I'll talk to them. You know, I've had some guys, I have a couple guys that have cried when I'm wrapping their hands, because it's time to fight, right? So I'll just kind of wait there. If I could get me chills right now, just thinking about it. I'll just wait there and let them get that out. And then I'll reinforce it with, look, man, you just go out there. I'm going to take care of you. Don't worry about nothing, man. You know, take care like you're my son. I want to make sure you walk out as handsome as you walk in and stuff like that. But every time I finish wrapping their hands, you know, I said, man, we always finish with a hug. I always give them a hug. And you know, that's, I understand. These guys are going to battle, bro. And, you know, like I said, the ultimate goal of a fighter is to render his opponent unconscious. Drew Fickett, this, maybe you're too young for this, Drew Fickett was part of the Matt Serra team. And Matt Brown beat the crap out of him. And I think Herb Dean was the referee. He stopped the fight, and doctor comes in, and he's arguing with him. No, I'm okay, this and that. I look at him, and I call him Drago, because I used to wrap his hands also. I said, Drago, look at me. You got knocked out. And he tells him, he goes, Stitch, I believe. So, you know, they know. I wasn't there to bullshit him, that I was going to be quite truthful with him. And you know, we always say in this game, the only thing that counts is the truth.
Not so much in the UFC, obviously, because you got like just the blue corner or the red corner. But when you sign up with like a boxer and you're part of their camp, is there like a process you do about, you know, meeting them, talking to them, finding out their facial structure, going into camp?
Yeah, it should be part of every cut man's trait. But Tyson Fury, good example, you know, in his last fight with Deontay Wilder, they brought me in like 2 weeks before this fight because of what had happened before. And Jose Capetillo, the cut man that worked on Tyson Fury before, told Tyson Fury, you know, bring in Stitch because he has a lot more experience than I do. And not that that was quite admirable. But as soon as I walk into the gym, Tyson's there, he puts his hand out and he welcomes me to the team. And, you know, we start talking about the cuts. You know, he shows me the cuts and I feel them, I look at them and you know, they did a good job. But then I go into the mechanics that here's what I'm going to do with you is I don't wait till you start getting swollen. I'm going to keep ice on you every round, especially if you're in a heated battle, whether you're swollen or not. I'm going to do preventive maintenance. And, you know, so we get that out of the way. And then, you know, once again, I let him know, you know, it's, you know, a handsome man. I'm going to make sure you walk out as handsome as you walk in, you know, works good because it's the truth. You know, you got to have a passion for what we do. And, you know, like I said before, if you do it for the money, you do it for the wrong reasons. You know, money comes with your success.
And do you check them out, see how they are like facially? Because obviously some people that just have a more protruding jawline, so they're more prone to cuts. Is that right?
Nah, man, a cut is a cut, bro. Mm-hmm. You know, I've gone through so many theories on cuts. And, you know, I look at your face, I say, okay, you might swell here, but you won't cut there only because you have a smooth surface. Some guys have that protruding bone line, you know, where you get cracked and you're going to get cut. But right. Nah, it's, you know, same thing with the theory of Vaseline. You know, you put Vaseline in theory so that the punches slip off and you don't get cut. But if that was the case, I wouldn't have a job. So, you know, so those are things I look at. Because you never know. It could be a punch from a certain angle. It could be a headbutt. It could be you always prepare for the worst case scenario.
It's kind of a strange job because you need something kind of bad to happen as such for you to kind of stand out.
Shh, don't say that now. Yeah, I'll tell you what, man, there's times when you do fights and then they're just like this, you know, okay, what am I gonna do? Once the time kicks in, it's like the fireman. Once that bell rings to that there's a fire, the guys come down the pole, they put their outfits in, they go to work. But once a fighter gets cut, then I gotta show what I know and I gotta take care of them at that point. But yeah, so you gotta be on alert.
So you joined the UFC, I think it was in 2001, and you had probably one of your most career-defining cuts that you ever worked on during the fight between Stephen Bonner and Forrest Griffin, which is actually in your book, Fields to the Garden, and was also, I think, on the front cover of the first UFC video game.
Yes. Well, the cut on Forrest in the video game was when he fought Shogun. When he had that big old cut, and I'll tell you that story there. But the one with Forrest and Stephen Bonner, yeah, I worked on him, and it was cool because there's nothing like behind the scenes. And I could stories, you know, fighters could give you stories, but nobody could give you behind the scenes like me with the fighters. So they were in a, you know, dogfight for sure. At the end of the fight, I'm cleaning up Forrest because, you know, he was bleeding air and all that and getting ready. And then we're waiting there for the decision, you know, me and the coaches there. And the coach next to me says, Stitch, I'm not gay, man, but I got to give you a kiss. Because, man, you did a great job, you know. And he did give me a kiss and did a great job. And but those are moments like that. But that cut on the first video game was when he fought Shogun. That was another historical fight because it was the first time a UFC fighter fought a Pride fighter. And that's when the UFC had fought Pride. So Flores had got this cut we call a lightning bolt. because it goes in different, there's a cut that just straight and there's a cut that goes here and then goes a different area. Forrest had that cut. And I go in there and I pull everything. I had the Avertine is one of the prescribed medications we use. And it's like a cotton. And it's what it does, coagulates the blood. The adrenaline is what we put in the swab that closes up the blood vessels. Well, I use them both, man. I got the adrenaline or the Avertine and I kind of plugged it up. And, you know, first I put the adrenaline to close up the blood vessels, and then the Avertine to kind of close it up. And yeah, it's, you know, Dana White's dad sitting next to me, Don House next to me. And I'm saying, man, it's not bleeding. He ends up winning the fight. And like a week later, I get a card and he sends me a nice coupon to a nice restaurant for thanks, for saying thanks. So I get that one straight. So that was good.
And the second one from the video game?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the second one was from the video game, as you see that cut.
So when you joined the UFC in 2001, and obviously there was, can you just set the record straight on why it is you left?
Yeah, it's pretty simple. You know, I always go back to when I was a farm worker, all right? And our Martin Luther King is a guy named Cesar Chavez. Cesar Chavez, we're farm workers. We work the fields. I mean, every fruit and vegetable you probably ate, I probably picked, including walnuts and almonds and apricots and figs and tomatoes and cotton and peaches and nectarines. I mean, it's what we did every year. You know, we always had work, right? But we never had working conditions. My mother, my sisters, you know, the ladies were working in the fields. They had to go to the restroom. They'd have to walk way, way, way out there and squat and go to the restroom. We would have the water we would drink. We all drank out of the same tin bucket with a tin cup, and you would get water and drink it and leave it there and fall in the dirt and mud and, you know, pesticides that be spraying, you know, the fields, and one, you know, with the planes would go by and they'd be spraying all that shit, right? But Cesar Chavez is the one that kind of got us unionized and got us better working opportunities. So my parents were always in that movement also. We were all in the movement. And so I got a call from John Nash on what happened on why I left the UFC. He wanted to know if I'd be interested in doing an interview on how the Reebok deal affected the UFC cutman. And at that time, I was making a lot more money through sponsors than what I was making with the UFC. I needed the UFC to make my money from sponsors. I had Tap Out, Bad Boy, One More Round, Rockwell Watches, Curtis & Company Watches, Zions. These were all companies that were paying me money. And so when John Nash called me about doing the interview, I thought about what my parents had gone through fighting for our rights. And I said, you know, if I didn't speak up for our rights, because I represented the cutmen. When they came to me for sponsors, I would close my deal, but then I would negotiate to get these guys some money also. Not as much, but something, you know, and which was, when you add two or three companies, they were quite happy. Leon Tappan bought a Cadillac, you know, so let you know, and he thanked me for that. But yeah, so the interview I did was very politically correct because I had worked corporate America, and I understood the principles of what the UFC was doing. But then that article went viral, and maybe not a good time for that article to have come out. And then maybe the thing that really crossed it is I said, maybe I have to concentrate a little bit more on boxing, because boxing, you know, working with one Tyson Fury fight is almost a year of working a UFC show, you know, so shows, you know, so the economics were different. And I guess maybe that's what set Dana them off. But anyway, the article went viral. And my wife and I are at Costco, we're shopping, and I get a call from one of my friends, one of the UFC guys. We're all friends. At that time, everybody was friends. And he says, hey, do you have time to talk? And I knew what the conversation was going to be, because I'm getting tons of messages. F Dana, F UFC, F Reebok, and I'm getting tons of getting calls, and everybody is, you know, acknowledging the article. Pick it up. It's at bloodyelbow.com. John Nash wrote the article. Very political. All the interviews I did, bro, people said, I read the article 6-7 times. you said nothing wrong. But it was just at the wrong time, at the wrong, it was like putting gas on a fire that was starting to turn off. So anyway, I get home and my other partner calls, and they're both executives with the UFC, and his voice is cracking. And right here in the same room, right, the chair that I'm talking to right here, he says, the only thing he says is because of the interview you did about Reebok, the UFC is not going to use you no more. And that kind of stung me big time. Yeah. So I said, all right. I said, well, Mark, do me a favor, man. Is you tell Dana I said that he ain't got no balls, that he should have called me personally because he's the one that brought me in. And I'm getting all these messages, bro, tons of. The first message I read is I respond back to the guy. And I think now that I know his name was Dave Estrada. And I say, look, because of the interview I did by Reebok, the UFC is not going to use me no more. Now I got to look for another job. And that shit went viral all over the world. I think in 1 week I did like 57 interviews. I had camera crews coming to my house. And I had Bad Boy that called me and they offered to make t-shirts and the profits would come to me. And Uriah Faber with his company, they promised they wanted to do the same thing. And I'm getting job offers from all over the world. And it was a trip, man. And it kind of made me the face of the rebellion. And first one to really speak out. And actually about a month and a half ago, I was working in the bubble with Top Rank boxing fights here at the MGM. So because of this COVID, we're in a bubble. But one of the coaches, one of the fighters was a Brazilian fighter, and his coach, Andres, I knew him because he worked with Vanderlei Silva, one of the top trainers. And we're having lunch and he says, you know, Spiesh, everybody respect you so much because you spoke up for us when we couldn't speak up. And I thought that again gave me chills right now because that was like years ago. That was like 5-6 years ago. And these guys have not forgotten. And I get comments all the time, and you know, people, they come up to me, Wesley Snipes, when I did the first Creed movie. I go to the premiere, and after we watch the premiere, and then after that we have a party, and Wesley Snipes comes up to me and he shakes my hand and he says, the only thing he says is, hey man, the UFC did you wrong. I said, wow, you know, so it pays to be truthful and it pays to fight for what you believe in and still continue doing what you're intended to do. So that's the story, bro. So if you got any questions regarding that, I'll answer them.
I'm assuming some of the fighters probably had your back because, like we touched on earlier in the interview, you know, Clay Guida, Machida, Misha Tate, you know, quite prominent people all, you know, said that they felt more confident with you in their corner. So did they ever campaign to get you back?
Yeah, everybody. Everybody called everybody, even the staff. And they knew that it was wrong. You know, everybody, you know, I had the people from Rising call me, you know, I had just job opportunities everywhere. And yeah, so, you know, I was here in this chair right here reading all the messages. And there's this one guy here in Las Vegas, Robbie LeBlanc, that has motivational money. You know, we're friends, motivational money. So every Monday he would speak about something to motivate you. And on this one, he says, hey, today's subject will be about speaking up for what is right and what is true. My friend, Jacob Duran, Stitch, known a UFC cup man, did this and this and this and that, and he lost his job because of this. Man, brother, I'm watching this video, and it got me so much that I started crying. I had so much positive energy that was coming, and I was just overflowed with positive energy from people that when he said that you know, I did what was right, I started crying. And my wife walks in and she's concerned. She's like, what's wrong? What's wrong? She sees the video and she starts crying, you know? So yeah, you know, those moments like that, man, that were, I knew I did the right thing. And, you know, people ask me, have you seen Dana since then? I said, nah, you know, well, what would you do? What would you say? I said, man, I'd shake his hand. And I'd say, you know, thanks for letting me go, because it's the best thing ever happened to me. So just being truthful.
So looking back, you would do it again?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I you know, the thing about it is it's never been about economics for me. It's been about doing the right things And yeah, of course, economics is important, no doubt about it. But yeah, my whole nature has always been to do the right thing, you know, just not screw over people. And, you know, and the thing about it, I always say when you do something wrong, that's what I always tell my kids, when you do something wrong, you know you did something wrong. You know, when you did something right, you know you did something right. So it's very simple.
A lot of water has kind of passed under the bridge since then. I think it was July 2015. If the door ever opened, would you go back?
Yeah, yeah, it'd have to be under different circumstances. You know, it had to be a half a package, you know, and because I represent so much now, you know, and you know, on the positive side, if the UFC, you know, wanted to do things good, they would at least. But yeah, we deal with eagles. I ain't got an eagle, you know. But I'm doing fine. I mean, I got some major projects coming up. I have things that I'm doing now that are because of what I've done. I'm working with a CBD company that created a cream for cuts. And when they called me, I asked, because I get calls all the time from CBD companies, pain relief and this and that. That's the new thing. And everybody has something. But when these guys called me about their cream for cuts for the healing process, I said, well, what proof source do you have? And that goes back to my days of working corporate America with RJ Reynolds. I understand the business. What proof source do you have? He said, well, we don't. That's why we called you. I said, all right, well, I could help you get proof sources. I work with the Bare Knuckle Fighting Championships here in the United States now. Let's go there, because these guys, they all get cut. 70% of them get cut, right? I said, let's go over there. And as they sew them up, take a picture of them, give them the cream, have them put it on every day. A week later, have them send you the results. And the results have been tremendous, tremendous. And one of the things that it minimizes the scarring, that was one thing we never expected it to have, but it has the CBD for the inflammation, stem cell, you know, for the growth of the tissue again, vitamin E, collagen. So it has all those things. So, and that's available at Cutman for Hire Supplies. So, you know, I'm working on that. I'm working on I think I'm going to be a consultant producer for a movie coming up, MMA movie in May and June. Can't give you no more than that. I expect to be gone 3 or 4 months, you know, doing that. And I'll still work, because I just got the assignments from Top Rank for continue working in the bubble. So I got 2 shows in April, another show in May, and then a couple in June. So on Fridays, I'll fly out, do the show, because they're all in the States. I'll do the show and then come back Sunday. So they're real good with me on that. So yeah, I'm working, you know, not a bad thing going on right now.
Does it hurt you at all that when, you know, Dana's commented on it, that saying that you were never friends, you were just business associates?
I think that was the stupidest thing he ever said in his life. It made me even prouder, you know, for him to have said that. Well, and to show you how big it was, because this was during the show when the UFC had their first appearance on Fox Network. Big, big network, right? And Karen Bryant is interviewing Dana. And that was such a big topic that she asked, will Stitch Duran ever come back? And for him to respond like that made him look like an idiot. Made him look like an idiot, you know. That's fine, you know. Who needs friends like that?
You've worked with some of the biggest names, you know, in boxing, in Pride, in, you know, every kind of fight sports there is. And you worked alongside Fedor Emelianenko. What was it like working with somebody like him, a man of few words?
Brother, what an honor. You know, when I was in Japan with Josh Barnett hired me when he left the UFC to work with him in Japan at the Pride fights. But everybody wanted me to wrap their hands. They were accustomed to, but Josh says, nah, you know what? I paid for him to come with me. If you want him to wrap your hands, it's going to cost you guys $500. And I'd make $2,000-$3,000 like this, man, you know? But the promoter comes in. Fedor had just come back from his first fight back from, he had broke his thumb like right here. And the promoter comes and asks me if I want to wrap his hands. And man, I mean, didn't even talk money at all. I was just honored to go wrap Fedor's hands. So I get in the dressing room, and I had worked with the Klitschko's before and some other Russians, and they're very quiet, right? But when I'm wrapping your hands, I like to talk to you and I like to shoot the shit and just find out where you're coming from. Fedor ain't saying nothing, man. You know, I ask him a question and, you know, so finally I finished wrapping his hands and I said, okay, how did they feel? He goes like this. Super, super. Bro, that's all he said, man. I walked out, I was so honored. And then, you know, after the fights, he had won. I think he fought Mark Hunt. I might be mistaken, but I think he fought Mark Hunt and won. And we're walking down the hallway back to the bus, and he sees Josh and I, and he brings us in, and he said, we drink placebo, and we drink shots of tequila or vodka. But let me show you something special, bro. I think you're one of the few to see this. Hold on. Now, I'm going to show you the relationship that I had with Fedor. After that, I always wrap his hands and his brother Alexander. So the last show that I did with Bellator when he fought in San Jose, I walk in from the airport, and him and his team are in the lobby. They're sitting down and all that. And he comes up to me, and he gives me a hug. He says, Stitch, I have some sweats for you. Send the guy upstairs, man. Look, nice, Fedor and Uncle Stitch, badass, huh?
Yeah, with your name on it?
Yeah, I got my name on it, you know. So these are the official sweats from Fedor Emelianenko. And the sweats are great. You know, I probably never wear them, you know. But it was the thought that when he was in Russia making his outfits, he thought enough of me to put my name on it. And that in itself is an honor. And you got time for one more? So I'm going to give you one more. Hold on, man.
Of course, yeah.
Hold on. All right, going back to wrapping hands, Brock Lesnar. Got a story with Brock Lesnar. Got a lot of stories for Brock, right? One, first of all, is I'm wrapping it. Well, when he came on with the UFC, he came on with the exception. He came on with the I want Stitch to wrap my hands. All right, so I was the designated guy to always wrap his hands. And I'm wrapping his hands one time, and I look at his T-shirt, and I said, hey, man, that's a nice T-shirt, you know. He goes, oh, I have one for you because I packed one for you. I said, oh, no shit. He goes, well, my wife, that when we're packing, she says, do I pack one for Stitch? And he says, yeah. So after I finished wrapping his hands, he goes and gives me a T-shirt, man. You know? And then you talk about the friendship. When he got cut, when he fought Cain Velasquez, big old nasty cut. I get on there and the whole swab literally goes in there. And between him and I, he's, you know, Stitch, take care of me. I said, yeah, of course, man, take care of me. But they were talking about him having the biggest gloves. Let me show you this, man. Very few people have seen this. Look at this glove. It's a Brock Lesnar glove.
He signed it, right, in the corner?
Yeah, he signed it. But what was a trip is when he was fighting Kane Carwin, I put the gloves on and they ripped just like the Hulk. And Burt Watson comes in and he said, man, Stitch, we got to, yeah, look, they're ripped right there. He said, we got to figure something out. We only got one more pair. And because these are 4X gloves. So the Klitschko's used to put Vaseline on their wraps and then slide the gloves in. And that's what I did with Brock and got the second pair on. And then he signed this one for me. So this is a memory I won't get rid of. But giant gloves.
Do you keep anything from all the fights you go to, programs? Do you keep the wraps? Or if a fighter that you're working with wins a world championship, do you ever keep anything as memorabilia?
Well, I have some. You know, I have one rap Andre Ward when he won the Super Six tournament. But got a lot of stuff in boxes, man. You know, my wife's not real big at making man caves, you know. But I got a lot of good memories from them. But more up here, a lot here, but definitely a lot of you know, like Tito Ortiz with, you know, Lyoto Machida, they all gave me their outfits and which is nice. So even Tyson Fury, I got the cornerman jacket that I worked with on him.
You know, watching you on TV, you obviously you wrap the hands, you put the Vaseline on their face, and then you usually kind of grab them and whisper something into their ear. What is it you're saying? I'm sure it's different for every fighter.
Yeah, it's different. You know, it's but it's their encouragements. You know, they go out there and kick some ass. You know, or you know, don't worry about nothing. I got you covered, you know. And who was it? Mike Pyle says, when I see Stitch walking in, I know I'm cut, but I know I'm okay, you know. And same thing with Andre Ward, you know, when he got cut, he goes, oh man, I got cut. Then I thought, no, I got Stitch in my corner, you know. But those little moments like that, that's, you know, you have to, it has to come from your heart and not do it because Stitch does it. You know, there has to be emotion. There has to be sincerity to that. And the only way to do it is to break sweat with these guys.
What is your pre-fight routine?
Good question, man. I'm going to tell you. My biggest pet peeve is wrinkled clothes. So I iron all my shit, everything. Yeah, and there was one guy that I worked the fight, and he pulled out a wrinkled satin cornerman jacket to work with this girl that was fighting for a world title. I made him take it off. I said, man, don't go embarrass her like that. But what I do is all the equipment, the gauze, the tape, good question. The gauze, the tape, the medications, the ice packs, I'll pull everything out. And I always, let's say I'm doing a boxing show and I'm only working with one fighter, but I always bring enough for five fighters, enough gauze and tape, enough of the medications, enough of everything, the swabs. I always bring enough for five fighters as a preventive. I always prepare for the worst case scenario, you know. And there's times when I'm in the dressing room, let's say it's boxing, and I'm wrapping a guy's hand, and somebody says, hey, Stitch, can you wrap my fighter's hands? So I always, you know, come prepared. But I'll go through the whole complete inventory. Even though I know what's in it, I'll do it just because of the discipline factor, just to be consistent. Good question, though.
And do you have to check the rules state to state? Because I'm sure it differs, right?
Yeah, they're pretty much the same. You know, when you have championship fights in boxing, they always have what they call the rules meetings after the weigh-ins, and they'll go through the rules. But yeah, I pretty much know them for every state, you know. And there's some that will give me a little bit more flexibility than they would in the rule books. I did a show in North Dakota, small commission, and the tape that I was using was a PowerFlex tape, kind of elastic and kind of adheres real good. And the commissioner says, you know, Stitch, we don't allow that here, but you can go ahead and use it. I've had doctors ask me as we're working, do they need stitches, you know? So, yeah. But, everything I do fair up in front. I'm there to screw the system or anything like that, because what I do is the best probability of getting the best results in the time that we do. So that's why I always try to teach is the right thing.
Have you ever been in an event and you've seen somebody and, you know, maybe he's got a really small corner because he's, you know, hasn't got much of a purse, and you've just said, you know what, I'm just going to jump in his team and help him out because he hasn't got a corner?
I do it all the time. Like four rounders, six rounders, you know, here in Las Vegas, I'm not traveling or anything like that. And I'll work their corners and I won't even charge them because they're not making money. And what I tell them is, look, the reason I'm doing this is so that you understand the importance of a good corner, the importance of having your hands wrapped properly, the importance. So I want you to understand that because this is your business and you are the fighter. You know, forget the managers and the head coaches. They're not head coaches or managers unless you have a fighter. And I try to always instill in these guys, you guys are the boss, and you should get treated as a world champ right from the beginning. And if they don't know, I'll show you how.
Obviously, you're probably the most recognizable cut man in the world. Where does the nickname Stitch come from? Because you actually don't stitch cuts.
No, yeah, I only got a high school diploma, bro. But, that's a good question. And I just wrote a bio. I wrote my bio out the other day for this upcoming movie, right? But when I was back in Fairfield, California, when I had my school of kickboxing, like I said, Dennis Alexia, which was the world champ at that time, he fought he was a main event, but Dave Rooney was his sparring partner and he fought one of the earlier fights. Well, at that time I was already a trainer, but I was learning to be a cut man. And at that time, the cut men would get tape and they would cut them in little strips and make sterile strips, right? They would just kind of rip the tape and all that. Well, Dave Rooney, now that I know what a cut is, the cut that he had was minor, you know, But I did the same thing. I got the tapes and I closed it up. And Dave Rooney says, oh, man, you saved me from going to the hospital and getting stitches. I'm going to call you Stitch. And that's where the name came from. And Dave Rooney right now is, last I heard, he's like a fisherman in somewhere in Alaska or something like that. But I don't know if he knows how much he influenced my life by that moment there in Vallejo, California. That's how the name came to be. And, you know, and it's funny because, you know, you don't give yourself a nickname. The nickname is given to you in honor. And to me, I was quite honored to have that. And people don't even know my real name. A lot of people don't even know my real name. You know, it's Jacob Duran, but, you know, even Leon Tabbs. We're, I think, in Australia, and Leon's calling the operator from my room, and he's asking for a stitch. And I've been working with Leon for years. But Leon was a little old school, right? So I understand. So she said, well, what's his name? He says, I don't know. I just know him as Stitch. So
obviously Fight Sports has grown and evolved, you know, massively ever since you started on the scene. How has your job changed in those years?
Since, say it again, please.
Obviously, Fight Sports has changed. You've been in it for what, like 30 years as a cut man?
Yeah, 30-something years, yeah.
How has your position, you know, changed over the years?
Nah, it just got better. You know, techniques, it's you're consistent in what you do for the opportunities that have to be taken care of. But, you know, I've seen them all. You know, I've seen broken bones, legs, I've seen broken hands, I've seen ears ripped, I've seen it all, right? And I learned how to deal with them. Cuts in the lip, cuts in the tongue, you know, and so, yeah, you know, just kind of learn off of that. But when I started becoming more and more experienced as a cut man, you kind of learn those through the trials, through the things that are happening. And there was a fight, a boxing show with Badu Jack, ended up with one of those Forrest Griffin cuts. You know, that big vein we have?
Yeah.
Well, that one popped and it bled. And you're talking about having a proper corner. Well, the corner should have stopped that fight because it was affecting him. And not only that, but if you understand the rules, if they would have stopped the fight before the fourth round, which had happened, it would have been an unintentional headbutt. And you could have negotiated for a rematch because this was the number one contention for a fight, for the championship fight. But they didn't. And even the cut man kind of freaked out a little bit. And so it's important to understand what happens in all situations.
Your job's obviously taken you around the world. Do you have any favorite countries or favorite venues that you enjoy going to?
Yeah, you know, Brazil was always nice. You know, just the climate, the beaches, the food, the people. It's got a lot of great places. You know, Japan, you know, they were always on point. You know, you say 12 o'clock, 12 o'clock. Australia, everywhere I've gone has been great. You know, I've had good moments just about everywhere. So, man, Germany, France, I mean, God, you know, Kazakhstan, Russia, been to all of them, you know, of course, Mexico, and yeah, so many different areas to go to. And you know, for the most part, when we go to shows, we'll stay within a 6-block radius of the hotel. You know, we're there to do business. Sometimes I'll go out and, you know, when I was in Brazil, I went out to in the jungles and swam with the waterfalls and stuff like that. And just, you know, got to take advantage of those type of things.
If you retired today, is there like a handful of injuries or cuts that spring to mind?
True. Yeah, you know, I always talk about Stefan Struve. And he just retired, by the way, because of injuries. But he fought this guy, Chris. I can't remember the guy's name. But Stefan's lip was shredded to the point where it looked like he was a shark. He just bit it, just shredded it. And he's in a battle and the doctor comes in and he's looking at the cut and Stefan still, you could tell he still wants to fight. But you have to understand the severity of cuts. Whenever a referee or a doctor stops to fight, it's because the fighter is at a disadvantage. Well, Stefan, outside of looking like shit, wasn't at a disadvantage and he still wanted to fight. So I told the doctor, I said, look, psychology again. I said, look, Stefan's going to be okay if you guys have a good plastic surgeon. And he let the fight continue. Stefan ended up winning the fight. And, you know, that's the story. But what makes that one funny is the guys in the truck that were producing the show heard the comments and they all started laughing, you know. And they're the ones that, I didn't know what happened. They're the ones that told me about it. You know, oh, man, it was great the way you ended up. But so many, you know, the Brock Lesnar cut, you know, the Drew Ficker cut, the one I just told you about, that just one with Wanderlei Silva when he fought Chuck Liddell, to me is the one of the top three toughest fights that I've worked, because they were both cracking each other. You just hear the punches. And Wanderlei Silva and the Brazilians, when we used to do shows in Japan, they gave me the name Santana, Carlos Santana, right? So I got a good friendship relationship with them, Wanderlei Silva, and I saw him like the week before, and I said, you know, Wanderlei, I'm going to give you some good karma, man. That day, Saturday is my birthday. I want to give you good karma. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Anyway, I'm working with Chuck Liddell in this fight, Leon Taj with Wanderlei, and they're just cracking each other, bro. Cracking each other. And Chuck gets a cut. I clean it up after the fight. I'll go up to the other corner as Leon is cleaning up Wanderlei, and Wanderlei's face is swollen. Looked like the elephant man. And I said, Wanderlei, how you doing? No, Steesh, I'm okay. And then after all this hard-ass battle, bro, looking like this, he says, Steesh, happy birthday. I said, man, bro, you know, what an honor. What an honor. Crazy.
You said that's in your top three of the toughest fights you've been ringside for. What are the other two?
Man, BJ Penn, when he fought Carl Uno, that was a tough fight. They were at it. But he knocked out, I think, Carl Uno. And Carl Uno comes up to me, and I try to hold him, and boom, he gives me a headbutt. Bam! And it didn't cut me. But, yeah, that was a tough fight, you know, working BJ Penn fight. But, man, I don't know which would be my toughest fight. I'd have to look at that one. But that one definitely, with Wanderlei and Chuck, definitely falls up there. But next time we talk, man, I'll give you the, you know, let me think about which are the two or three fights. There's been so many, man. There's been so many when, you know, the thrill of victory, the agony of defeat, you know, which are heartbreaking. Heartbreaking are when Drew, no, what the hell is his name? Dale Hart fought, I forgot the guy's name, and he broke his leg. And the guy's in pain, man. And I'm on my knees and I'm holding his shoulders, and he says, he's in pain. Stitch, what happened? What happened? And I look at his leg, and his leg is going this way and his foot's going this way. And I said, man, you broke your foot. Go ahead and scream all you want. And he, of course, they shoot him up with morphine, and they put him on the gurney to take him out of the ring. And he's not feeling no pain at that point. He looks at me, he says, Stitch, I almost had him. I said, man, that's the heart of a warrior, you know, and just crazy moments.
You've been in several movies and you actually nearly turned down appearing in Rocky. Is that right?
Yeah. My wife talked me out of it. She said I was crazy. They called me to do Balboa with Rocky's last fight, but I had a championship fight boxing in Paris, France with Fabrice Tiozzo from Paris, from Lyon. And then Audley Harrison was the Olympic gold medalist heavyweight from the UK. Mm. And I told him no. And I called my wife at work and I said, look, man, they want me to be in this movie. I can't do it because I got to go to France. I got to go English. She goes, are you crazy? Rocky's an American icon. You have to do it. And I responded back, and it turns out that the fight with Audley Harrison, they understood. Turns out that the fight in Paris got canceled anyway. So listen to your wife, bro. So.
And working in Ocean's 11 is actually strangely how you actually ended up on Team Klitschko.
Yeah, that was, let me just send my daughter this real quick. Zoom meeting. Yeah, you know, and I say 1991, Vitaly says 1992, but it was December the 12th. When the Soviet Union first broke, Ukraine had their first professional fights, and they invited a team of boxers and kickboxers from the U.S. to fight the Ukrainians. And at that time, I had Mark Longo, which was a kickboxer. So we go there, and at that time, the Klitschkos were young kids, but they were already superstars. And I saw them at a distance, never met them. And when they started training in Vegas, then I met them, and I showed them the poster, and that's how we connected. But when Ocean's 11 came, I'd been in movies already, played to the bone, I kind of got hooked. So I went, and they got me on to be Vladimir's cutman in the movie. And it turns out that after that, he told Emmanuel Stewart that he wanted the guy that was the cut man in the movie to work with him. And I worked with him for 12 years, his brother like 10 years. So.
And was that just due to the fact of he liked the way you wrapped the hands, or?
I didn't wrap his hands or nothing at that time. It was just, I guess, the bond, the communication that we had. And knowing that I was already a cut man. But Emmanuel Stewart was commentating for HBO, and there's a show at the MGM, and you're talking about the last round. I used to co-host a radio show called the 13th Round here in Las Vegas. So me and my partner, Nick Ward, are watching people going to the people watching. And Emmanuel Stewart goes by and says, I need to talk to you about working with Vladimir. And he goes like this. And I asked Nick, I said, did you see what I saw? Next day, he calls me and says, Vladimir wants you as a cut man.
Do you ever have to pinch yourself and sit there and just think about where you are now?
It blows my mind every day. You know, and one of the stories I tell is when I did Creed, you know, I spent 6 weeks with Michael B. Jordan, one-on-one, like this, wrapping his hands in the trailer, him and I, shooting the shit. Sylvester Stallone, you know. But in the Creed, I'll give you a little behind the scene. When I got the script for Creed, my name was Marcel. And I think, well, gee, I don't know anybody named Marcel. I got to have to change that, not knowing what Hollywood is. But when it was time for Rocky to introduce us to Adonis, he goes and says, this is Stitch, the best cut man in Philadelphia. And bro, right off the bat, who's going to tell Rocky, no, you can't use Stitch? Well, the next day I thanked him. And he says, no, it has to be authentic. But then I also told him, I said, you know, man, I can't sleep at night. So I'm here in Philadelphia. I'm doing the movie with you, Michael B. Jordan, Ryan Coogler, the director. And man, what am I doing here? He said, no, you earned it. You know, you earned that position. And at this point, yeah, I'm still that little kid that grew up as a farm worker doing this. And it blows my mind. And things just, they just keep piling up. Better things, better things, better things. And, you know, my sister, she calls me lucky. You know, well, you're lucky. You know, it just shit happens. But to this point, I swear, I've never asked for one job. You know, they just happen. You know, and here I am.
And it's either you or your double stars in the TV series, The Mayans.
Edward James Olmos. So.
How often do you get, how often do people confuse you for him?
All the time. And it's funny because when we did the second Creed movie, we're on a break and Sylvester Stallone and me and the other guys we're with the makeup people there. And Sly's friend, Frank, is telling the makeup people how Stitch is famous for this and that. He looks like Edward James Olmos. And this quick role, Sylvester Stallone's like this with his arms crossed. And like this, he says, more like Edward James Olmos. And I said, wow, man, that's a cool shot, but what can I say? But I did a movie with, I don't even consider it a movie because it was an independent, with him and Anderson Silva. But I told him, I said, man, all the time, people confuse me for him. Well, when I first met him, I was doing a UFC at the MGM. And I knew that him and Anderson Silva were going to do a movie. So I knew he was going to be there. Of course, he was a big idol of mine because he's Mexican. And, you know, he did the thing. So I'm in the back wrapping somebody's hands. And one of the UFC staff says, Edward James Olmos wants to meet you. I said, oh, shit, you know. So I finished wrapping the guy's hands. I walked down the hallway and I turned the corner and they got the green screen there for the fighters. They take pictures before and after. And he's there looking at me and we're like 6 feet apart from each other. And we start laughing. So man, it's the same thing. But he says, he goes, hey man, I'm walking into the arena and people are saying, Stitch, Stitch. And I told him, I said, man, you know, people stop me and they think I'm you, you know? And I get to the point where people are asking me for pictures. I said, okay, who do you think I am? You know, am I Carlos Santana? Am I Edward James Olmos? Am I Stitch? You know, and sometimes I would have to correct them. I said, no, I'm not Edward James Olmos. You know?
Have you ever signed an autograph just pretending, just playing along?
No, but you know what? I did that with Carlos Santana. we were coming back from a UFC in Connecticut, and I don't know if you've ever been to Las Vegas, but they have the trams from the gates to baggage claim, right? So these guys are messing with, I have a hat on like Santana. Got a New Japan jacket that I got from New Japan Pro Wrestling. And we're on the train and these guys are messing with the audience and or the people on the train and saying, hey, Carlos, and man, I love your music. And they're all looking and they're getting closer. And this little girl from El Salvador comes up and she says, are you really Carlos Santana? And I said, yes. She goes, oh my God, in Spanish, my mother, she loves you. She says you play like an angel and this and that. Can we take a picture? And I took a picture with her, bro. And then baggage claim, she comes with her grandmother and we take another picture. And I never wore that hat again. I never told her I wasn't Carlos Santana. I know she went home to her mom. She goes, that's not Carlos Santana. So.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny. What would you tell a 20-year-old Jacob Stitch Duran if you could speak to him?
Well, you know, I guess as I tell everybody is follow your dreams because they do come true, you know, and I guess I've learned through experience, and I would tell Jacob also is, and I'll tell you also, is that little line that we're scared to cross to get into a new venture. If you don't cross that line, you'll never know, you know, and have confidence in yourself. That's what I would tell myself. And, you know, it's what I'll tell everybody. Follow your dream.
I think that's a great place to leave it. Stitch, if you want to tell us all of your social media, if you want to promote anything that you've got coming up.
Yeah, social media at Stitch Duran, you know, and it's funny because, you know, I've done these KSI, Logan, Jake Paul fights, and I've gotten so many new followers because it's a whole different world. So, but I am, it looks like I'm going to be working or they're negotiating and closing the deal with former world champ Antonio Tarver's going to fight Frank Mir and when Jake Paul fights Ben Askren on these cards. And to me, they're fun. You're talking about the change of the game. Well, me as a cut man, that remains the same, but the game has changed to the point now where you have this type of entertainment, and it's fine with me.
One last question. Will you be working Tyson Fury's corner?
I think that's the plan. You know, I never say yes until I get the call, but I think the chances are excellent. You know, I'm working in the top ranked bubble fights, and, you know, they manage Tyson Fury, but Tyson Fury, the whole team liked what I brought to the table. So I would lean more towards yes than no. So I'll let you know. Call me when the time comes. I'll give you behind the scenes stories.
And if you want to promote your apparel, your Cutman website as well before.
Yeah, well, the Cutman website is Cutman4Hire4. So it's Cutman, the number four, for hire. Juan Ramirez runs that, but he carries everything for us. So if you guys need the best, that's where you want to go. And Avi brought up my book, From the Fields to the Garden, 1 and 2. That's available at Amazon.com. And now they're starting to film a documentary based on the book, on my life. So hopefully that'll be coming out pretty soon. And one more round was one of my sponsors that had to let go when the UFC went into Reebok. But looks like we're teaming up again. And then this pandemic hit. So hopefully when things get back to normal, we'll be able to reboot one more round. So, but no, thanks for having me on, man. It's a good show. Congratulations on your first show. Definitely, you got to have me on when it's 100.
Definitely, yeah. We'll definitely have you on for some even more tales.
Yeah, got a shitload of them. Nobody has what I have. Yeah. You know.
And you can find us on social media at TLRMMA and tune in a few weeks while I'll have our second guest. This is The Last Round.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Last Round MMA Podcast. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes and interviews. In the meantime, follow The Last Round MMA on Twitter and Instagram at TLRMMA.